welcome to the Future Thinkers Podcast. I'm Mike Gilliland.
And I'm Yulia Ivanova. And this podcast is all about the future. Welcome.
You're doing this every time. Welcome, freak bitches. You're copying Joe Rogan. I don't think Joe would appreciate this.
All right,
welcome,
no more.
Freak bitches.
No more.
It sounds so innocent, too. So this one's a cool episode. We did an interview with a gentleman named Zoltan Istvan. Zoltan is an American writer, futurist, and philosopher, and transhumanist. And he has recently announced his intent to run as a 2016 U.S. presidential candidate. That's pretty interesting.
Yeah, Zoltan's been a journalist for a long time. He's written for Psychology Today, Vice's Motherboard, Huffington Post. And he used to be a journalist with National Geographic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he even did, he covered the bomb diggers in Vietnam and Cambodia. And there's a couple of interesting videos you can see of him actually right up close while they're digging out a bomb. It's pretty scary. So check that out. Yeah. Anything else? Okay, we'll get into it. Enjoy. Zoltan Istvan, thank you for joining us.
Zoltan Istvan, I think, is the correct pronunciation. Am I right?
You know, it's however you like to say it. It's pretty complicated. Even I don't pronounce it properly, but you did pretty good with it. So that's all fine. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks for joining us. So we're calling you from Vietnam. As we've done our research, we found that you've done some National Geographic stuff on bomb digging, and you've spent some time in Southeast Asia. So why don't you tell us a bit about that?
Sure. Well, I used to be the communications director of WildAid in Cambodia, which at the time was their largest country. They had about 1,000 people, about 15 employees, but literally like 1,000 soldiers that were working for the government, as well as just lay people. And what they did was, we were trying to protect endangered wildlife, and we were trying to stop poaching. And the Cambodian government had got involved and actually allocated a huge amount of their soldiers to help us stop wildlife poaching, which was great. So, but as a result, I had spent a huge amount of time in all of Southeast Asia, and also, you know, years before on my sail trip, I had left my boat in Singapore and also did a number of trips through there. So I'd been all over. But yeah, the bomb digger story for National Geographic Channel was one of my favorites. And that was done directly in Vietnam in the DMZ, in a demilitarized zone for your audience. And that was on basically trying to recover unexploded ordnances that the American government had dropped on the country. And it was a fascinating story because there's a lot of humanitarian elements of farmers now digging up bombs to sell the metal. But I loved it all there, and I loved the food, and I really loved the people too.
That's pretty incredible. I was just watching the National Geographic, and there's at the part where he's kind of digging for the bomb, and you're up really close. You're like, whoa, stop. And you're like, run away. That was crazy. Like that, your adrenaline must've been going.
I was, you know, because they, you know, first off, not only being just a Buddhist nation, but they work with these kind of unexploded ordnances all day long. And so they're pretty used to what they know, what they see. But I see anything round, anything shiny, and I just assume it's some type of bomb or landmine. And, you know, I was freaked out. And that was one of the instances that we actually got on film. But there were a number of times when we had something similar like that happen when it wasn't on film. And you know, by the end of 7 days of filming that episode, I was so freaked out. Really, it was like I was on pins and needles, because anytime you have to go off the path, you're totally worried about landmines. You're totally worried about anything, you know, just blowing up. Because the bottom line is, the American government dropped literally millions and millions of tons of this type of weaponry, and about 10 to 15% of it goes unexploded. So even now, there are hundreds and hundreds of thousands of unexploded bombs in the jungles in Vietnam. And all of that just can sometimes take a nudge and it can explode or something like that. So, you know, it's a pretty scary story, and I had a great time doing it. And it was a great story, did actually a lot of good, because a lot of donations were made once the video came out. At the same time, it was one of the most important stories I've ever done, because afterwards I came back and dedicated my life to transhumanism, because I was so scared after working 7 days in the DMZ with these farmers, you know, digging up these bombs.
Right. I guess after that you started thinking, well, how can I back up my brain in case this kind of thing happens and my physical body gets all wrecked, so I can restore it into a mechanical body from a backup?
Yeah, no, well, really, it was the incident in Vietnam. So just to back up a little, I had been about 4 years with National Geographic, and I don't know exactly how much, but a large portion of that was in conflict zones. And I would consider at that point, you know, that kind of story sort of still a conflict story in the sense that you were really worried about your safety all the time. And, you know, it's pretty nerve-wracking to be a journalist in conflict zones. I did a couple of wars, the Kashmir-Pakistan war, Kashmir war between India and Pakistan. And there's it just kind of takes its toll on you. And what happened was Vietnam was kind of at the very end of 4 years of doing a lot of pretty dangerous stuff. And I had this one incident where I almost stepped on a landmine. My guide pushed me out of the way. And I'd been a transhumanist for years before this. But that was the moment when I said, you know what? I'm going back to America. I want to dedicate my time and my life to trying to live indefinitely and pushing science and technology forward as a way to do that. I actually, after that Vietnam story, never really traveled again for journalism. I sort of went back to America and began writing my novel, The Transhumanist Wager, and sort of dedicated it more to the field of science. And so Vietnam was a very critical point in my life that week when I was covering these bomb diggers.
Wow. You took off from Vietnam and went back to the States, and you started to get into transhumanism, and that's at the point that you wrote your book. Can you tell us a bit about the book?
Sure. So, you know, nothing was so like overnight, but I had been a transhumanist essentially since I've been in my early 20s when I was studying philosophy at college. But, you know, it took a while to kind of get into my head that I should actually do something directly for the movement, even though I was very supportive of it. So I think the Vietnam story was somewhere I was around 28 or 29 years old, or maybe 30 at that point. And then I returned to the United States, and I had a couple different things happen before. I had a real estate business, real estate development business that I worked with. But I was already beginning to write articles kind of specifically about technology. I was continuing to write for the National Geographic website. And then I began my novel, which was The Transhumanist Wager. And that took a full 4 years to write. And it's a very philosophical book. About 20-30% of it is pure philosophy. It's a novel following the protagonist, Jethro Knights, and his main mission in life is to overcome death, biological death, using science and technology. He's a complete atheist. And it took so long to write the book that I really worked my way through the philosophy. And then when I released it, luckily, the book did really well. It, you know, became a number one bestseller in philosophy on Amazon, as well as science fiction visionary. So it kind of made its rounds around the community, and it somewhat, to some extent, launched my career as a futurist. And, you know, this is now 2-3 years ago, and ever since then, I've been advocating for futurist issues and transhumanism, and especially science and technology to make us live longer, to make us live better, to make us live healthier. And, you know, ultimately, that's sort of landed me here as the founder and the U.S. presidential candidate of the Transhumanist Party, where I'm now like taking it to a political level and really trying to change the political spectrum with my ideas and with the, you know, the philosophy of transhumanism.
We just watched Joe Rogan's episode with you last night, and that's when we kind of first heard about you running for presidential candidacy. So that's been a few months ago. How has it progressed since your interview with Joe?
Well, you know, so first off, the interview with Joe was excellent and really did help a lot because he's such a popular guy, and he has such a very different audience too. It's one of the main things with journalism is not just hitting the same audience you usually hit, but to try to hit new audiences to gain, you know, more people learning about transhumanism. So, you know, I declared my candidacy very early in kind of the presidential race. But, you know, as I've mentioned in my articles, my candidacy, there's no chance of me winning the presidency. A lot of it is just as a kind of a method to try to not only further establish the Transhumanist Party, which is a political nonprofit that is, you know, like any other third party, like the Green Party or Libertarian Party, we're trying to grow bigger so that one day we might actually win an election and also have not only just the presidential race, but also people in Congress and people in local government. So it's been very good in terms of our publicity and our media coverage. We've had a huge amount of people. I've just interviewed today with the Daily Beast, which is a major publication about parts of my presidential candidacy. And so it's going good in that terms, but it's also very difficult because, as you know, from any third party in America, there's virtually no chance of winning. It's just if you're not Republican or if you're not Democrat, it's very hard to get a foothold in the door. So we're doing our best to use the party as well as my candidacy as a means to spread transhumanism, which is essentially this techno-optimistic message that, hey, science and technology is very beneficial to the human race and can help us all. But I'm not 100% sure, you know, where the end result is, whether the Transhumanist Party will actually become large enough at some point in the future to maybe win an election. Certainly can win on the local level, but it's hard to know. The two-party system in America is so set in stone that it's sometimes pretty daunting.
I was thinking, as a transhumanist, it kind of seemed almost a polar opposite ideology to be getting involved in politics and want to change the system from within the system. I suppose from the perspective of PR and spreading the message, it makes a lot more sense.
Yeah, because, you know, transhumanism is a very exponential ideology where you always have to be open to rapid changes, and lack of regulation definitely helps those rapid changes. And the current political systems are very heavy on regulations and are very linear. I don't know if you saw that article that Peter Diamandis wrote about that recently, but he's essentially saying that the political systems of today will very likely not survive the singularity or even the pre-singularity time because they're very linear.
Yeah, no, I definitely agree with Peter there. I would be very surprised if in 25 to 35 years, we still have such a just really heavy and concrete two-party system. Part of the reason is that democracy is going to become much freer when we all have access to vote on our iPhones, or we all have access, and not just voting, but the access to immediately change things. I've written an article for Vice Motherboard where I have a column on this idea. It's called the transhumanist future of politics, where, you know, democracy can be real time. You can set up a, you know, say something like, hey, we should have a universal basic income, and then okay, everybody in the next week vote on it around the world. And because everybody is so interconnected, you can decide something like almost immediately. And that's a system that is quite different than the one we have now, where it's like so much infighting in Congress. It takes, you know, months and sometimes years to get any kind of bill passed. And then all of a sudden, when it does get passed, you know, someone can veto it or all these other things. So I'm thinking that technology is going to really change the way politics acts. Now, the thing is that it's not going to change it, of course, by 2016 and probably not even by 2020 or 2024. I have ambitions to run again when hopefully the party's a lot bigger, and maybe then some, you know, I'll have a better chance. But certainly, I think within 15 or 25 years, when we probably no longer have iPhones, we'll probably have brain implants that act as exactly the same way. And we may not even speak spoken languages anymore because we'll just think these things. You know, they already have telepathy. It was launched last year. And so there's a whole bunch of new types of technologies that are going to change the way we think, the way we communicate, and also the way we, you know, deal with voting and politics. And if it can be that much more efficient, you can expect that the existing political systems are either going to have to completely adapt, which is very unlikely because they're so, you know, they're just lumbering and slow, or we'll just have new political systems appear and perhaps even virtual states. I do advocate, to some extent, you know, I'm running for the United States presidency, but and I love America and all these other things, but I realize that 25, 35 years down the road, it's very possible we could just have an Earth with no national borders, with no multiple currencies, with no languages, because everything will be translated immediately with brainwaves and like Google Translator does. And so we'll just be much more one, I think, with one another. And in that sense, that could really transcend the kind of conflict that we always have with politics, or the bad taste that we have with it, where it's so hard to get anything done and it's like nothing ever really moves forward, it seems. So I'm pretty optimistic that, yeah, technology will absolutely change politics in the future.
It's hard for me to wrap my head around the idea that we could actually change the political system as it is. It just seems so mired in the way things have always been done. And watching movements like the Occupy Wall Street movement, what's your take on that sort of maybe revolutionary perspective in politics, and especially the apathy that young people have as far as getting involved in a political system that doesn't really represent them to begin with?
Well, you know, so I was pretty supportive of the Occupy movement, not necessarily so supportive of all the ideals because it was a little bit all over the place. But what I was very supportive of is the idea that there was this group out there doing a movement, any movement. Revolution is somewhat always necessary, especially in a democratic society, to move forward. I mean, it's the youth that always has been able to change us. So it's important that they stand up. And I was a little bit sad that they didn't go further with it, that it didn't become something more like the 60s, where there really was a culture that developed and took over. And that could be part of the failing of this kind of system that we live in now. In my novel, The Transhumanist Wager, I talk a lot about this idea of baggage culture, which is this idea that culture is getting heavier and heavier and heavier. And it's almost impossible to kind of throw it off. And as a result, it's exactly what governments and corporations and all these other people want, because you're so totally entrenched in the system. That said, I don't think governments and corporations are going to be able to keep up with the technology. I think on the other hand, there's this idea of what the internet has done and what biotechnology will do. And, what, for example, telepathy and mind reading and bionics and robotic hearts will do. It could literally change the kind of fabric of what it means to be a human being. And so I'm optimistic that over the long haul, there will be some substantial changes in the system that will give people more ability to feel like they're represented, more ability to feel like there's value in their voice. At the same time, I think, it's going to take some real effort. Maybe the Occupy people didn't push hard enough. Maybe there wasn't enough demonstrations. There wasn't enough just kind of really rallying behind the concept and pushing forward. It's very important if you're trying to do something revolutionary that you follow through with it and you don't give up and you absolutely just insist on making the changes.
That's pretty brave to say as someone who wants to get in politics. Even just looking you up in YouTube and seeing the headlines from your talk with Joe Rogan, there was one about, kids should do psychedelics. And of course you were misquoted there, but it's it must be difficult to talk about these kind of things. But then again, I kind of wonder if your view in politics is more of a small stepping stone to what you think we will become in the future. And your involvement kind of seems like just a push for awareness more than a real attempt to be president one day.
Well, the truth is that it is a push for awareness. I would love the opportunity, and I've discussed even with my wife some of the possibilities that could happen that could really shoot me to national attention, where all of a sudden it becomes something possible. I mean, there are always methods to, all of a sudden you get launched and then you're there on the national stage and you can actually maybe have a real chance. But at this point in time, it really is about awareness. And so I do have the luxury of saying some radical things. I do have, and it's not just radical things. What I think I really have the luxury of saying is saying the things that are on my mind. For example, in the interview today, I was asked about some of Rand Paul's ideas on drugs and stuff like that. And I have the luxury of not, I'm going to get misquoted and I'm going to get bashed in the press, but it's nowhere near what could happen if Rand Paul did that, where he could lose all his popularity through saying one wrong thing. I still have the luxury of saying a lot of what's really in my heart and trying to say the best thing I can for society. And that's a very funny zone to be in, because you're just popular enough to be able to do that, but you're not popular enough to be able to sink the ship. It's a very great a very nice place to be in, actually, because you can still write truly opinionated and editorial articles and say things and get away with it and still be your honest self. I do feel like a lot of the politicians that get to these higher places of power and popularity, they're basically just losing themselves because they, in order to win, you really need to appease the most amount of people. And that's a very dangerous place to be in, because it challenges your own set of integrity. You're like, oh, I want to say this, but at the same time, I want to be elected in. So luckily, I'm not dealing with that too much. And I have a lot of the luxury of just being totally honest to what I feel and what I believe and can say it. And I'm hoping that more and more people listen and I kind of act as that outside voice and saying, well, what if we did it this way, the transhumanist way or this kind of more sketchy way? It seems a little bit radical, but it might just be actually better for the people. So anyways, I'm in a wonderful place and I actually love it because I can still voice my opinion and know that I can continue without actually being that slaughtered. But that Mark Dice thing that you had mentioned where I had said something about drugs are good for kids, they really misquoted me. I mean, from a journalistic point of view, that is like almost absurd. You know, I absolutely did not say that, and they know that. But that's digital media these days. You can twist anything around.
Yeah, I suppose
it's clickbaity.
it's clickbait, and he does well. I mean, he's a popular guy because of those kind of titles.
I'm actually curious. You don't have to talk about this if you don't want to, but I'm curious about your views on psychedelics because you did seem to be sort of in support of it.
Sure. And funny enough, the Daily Beast article I think should be out tomorrow asked me about all these questions because it was about nootropics. And I have done psychedelics. I think for experimental purposes, they're absolutely wonderful to do. As a general rule, the Transhumanist Party and myself hold a kind of decriminalization process for the entire drug industry. We just don't think, unless you're doing something violent or hurting someone, you should be going to prison for doing any types of drugs. Now, it doesn't mean that I'm allowing hard drugs and we would, support something like that. Certainly, there should be some rehabilitation and stuff like that involved with people that have addiction problems and whatnot. But honestly, supporting a multi-billion dollar prison industry in America, which is something like, 5 or 10 times larger than any other country in the world, and a lot of them being drug users, is absolutely asinine. It's crazy. We could spend that money on education, especially when a lot of these people haven't actually even committed violent acts. So, eventually I'm going to be writing here probably the next month a full editorial piece on my views on how we can kind of entirely end the war on drugs and take it to a place where we encourage some experimentation with drugs and where we try to take the real mean stuff or the hard stuff and get people off it or get them to a point when they can actually, say, have a better feel for where their life is going and they want to stop on their own rather than just, sticking them in prison and just spending this tons of money. And, regarding marijuana and some of the other things like psychedelics, I'm just not, at least some of the milder psychedelics, it's amazing that we have made it illegal. I think people grow through these experiences, just like you have said. And I grew through my experiences too. When I was in Costa Rica and I walked out into a field and, picked mushrooms and then had some of the most amazing experiences of my life, experiences that have stayed with me for a massive amount of time and also been kind of critical to how I philosophically view the world. The idea that you can know that your mind can change just from trying a drug really shows you how not only volatile the world is, but also how not objective it is. That when people want to defend their values, defend their religions, defend their ideals, they need to take a step back and say, whoa, we can have more peace if we just realize that everything can change very quickly, even just through a simple mushroom or something of that nature. So I think we could find a lot more peace if we would just take a kind of a step back and say, maybe experimenting with substances is okay. And after all, it's a very transhumanist idea. I think most transhumanists have experimented with substances and they feel it's part of self-improvement, which is what transhumanism is all about.
Yeah, we both absolutely agree with that. Yeah.
Did you see that article recently? I can't remember which publication it was, but it talked about that they've found the real cause of addiction and that it's not actually drugs that cause addiction, but mental problems and loneliness and abuse. So, when people don't feel like they're whole, they resort to drugs. And they tested it on mice and they put mice in isolation and gave them drugs. And of course, the mice became addicted to drugs. And then they put mice in a social situation where they were very comfortable and they could run on their little wheel and exercise. And they found that the drug-addicted mice stopped taking the drugs. And the other mice didn't even try the drugs. So it's a problem of, just feeling alone and not supported by your community rather than just the drug being there.
You know, I remember seeing that headline, didn't read it, and that your summary of it was great. But I would not be surprised if that's exactly the case, because alcohol is very similar to that. You know, not that many people drink when everything is going great. And alcohol, I think, is one of the most addictive properties, you know, we have. But when things are going bad is when people kind of start to drink. And I wouldn't be surprised to find something just like what you said happening. And I also think it's important to know that in the future, when we have brain implants and when we have other types of technologies around us, for example, just in our living room, we're going to have, sort of cameras that are helping us to turn on the TV just by thinking it or looking at it and stuff like that, or some kind of alarm on the refrigerator that won't allow us to eat all the chocolate ice cream. You know, these kind of things are coming. You know, we already have all these crazy apps on our iPhone that sort of keep us healthier. And, you know, now everyone's wearing these wearable technology things where, you know, they monitor your heartbeats and other things like that. Eventually, we're going to be a society that's very monitored. And that would be very good, because if you want to, you know, for example, you have an addiction to cigarettes and you say, oh, I'm going to go get one, your phone might beep at you and say, hey, you know, Zoltan, don't do that. I don't smoke, but you know what I'm saying? It could be something like that. But the point is that once we have all this technology around us, it will also help us to not do things the bad way, but instead to do things the good way. And I've written before about my, you know, iPhones will be flying in probably 2 or 3 years, meaning that they will be sort of like these better angels of our nature sitting on our shoulders, telling us what to do and what not to do based on what we think is right. And at some point, we'll have this sense that, you know, drug use or addictions or things that we do that are wrong will be stopped ahead of time just because something has reminded us not to do it. And so I also think for that reason alone, it will end. And, you know, I just was telling some of the journalists today that the greatest thing about driverless cars, for example, is that there's going to be no more drunk driving accidents. So, you know, there's still like, I think, 100,000 deaths a year from drunk driving accidents. So can you imagine with driverless cars, no one's going to be drunk anymore. So this is the way that technology is going to sort of help us eliminate this kind of negative idea of what substance is. And hopefully we'll be back to the kind of Timothy Leary age where, hey, substances are something to grow on, something to experiment with, something to enjoy, as opposed to, you know, this idea when you think of alcohol, you think, oh, you know, I have two young daughters. I don't want them drunk driving. I don't want anyone else drunk driving them. So, you know, it's great to think of how technology, especially through things like driverless cars, will empower us rather than make us something, you know, put us in these very dangerous positions where still hundreds of thousands of people die.
I think a lot of us could really use the experience of a couple of mushroom trips to kind of regain that empathy that is pretty easy to lose in modern society. That's how it's definitely helped me, is taking mushrooms and realizing there's this old capacity for empathy that I've almost shut off, and that just reopening it every once in a while is a really good thing. It allows me to connect and helped in all kinds of areas of my life. And I kind of wish that more people would let themselves have that experience.
And for me, a lot of it, especially as an aspiring politician, is really just about saying, wow, we're spending billions and billions and billions of dollars on this thing for these people that they don't really need to be locked up. And more importantly, we could be spending those billions and billions and billions of dollars on education or on infrastructure or on new technologies that can eliminate heart disease or cancer. I mean, instead of a war on drugs, we need a war on cancer. We need a war on heart disease. These are things that really, truly affect people in the most horrible way. I mean, you can see it. People die from this stuff. So I think, you know, that's where my agenda is where I want to put, instead of some of these frivolous things where we spend, you know, war on oil, far off lands and nobody ever goes to, or war on drugs, let's spend on the things that really matter. Everyone knows someone who's died from cancer. Everyone knows someone who has heart disease or diabetes. These are things that really matter. We can change the way America deals with its citizenry just by saying enough of this nonsense. Let's put the resources and the money we have into the things that really can make a difference in our daily lives.
So do you believe it's the younger generation that is going to be the catalyst for this kind of change?
So, you know, here we run into the greatest conundrum of life extension science that I can think of. The idea that science and technology is really great. It's making people live longer and longer. But the problem is that the politicians that have been stifling America for so long are going to live longer and longer as well, especially since they have some of the most resources and money to put into their own health. So this really presents a challenge for politics, because you can have a, you know, these senators and these people stay in office forever, and they continue to hold their very same viewpoints, especially from my atheistic point viewpoint. They can hold their religious ideals, and they will say, well, drugs are bad forever, because that's just what they've been thinking for the last 70 years. And unfortunately, because of life extension medicine, which I completely support, they are going to now live to 150 years and still probably be in office. So that is a real problem. I think in this way, we might have to actually think of having some kind of term limits on the amount of time that certain people, and maybe age limits that people can stay in. Recently, I had advocated for making sure that a broad base of different types of jobs reach into Congress. You know, currently it's something like 40% of Congress is made up of attorneys, and attorneys have a very specific mindset on how to deal with the world. And unfortunately, attorneys in the real world only make up around 7% of the population. So there's a huge discrepancy between these people running our country and the actual amount of them that are on in America. I would like to see plumbers. I would like to see construction workers. I want to see writers. I want to see journalists, doctors. I want to see everyone represented equally for whatever, you know, population they represent in America. And I think the same thing should be in age groups. And the same thing should be, and I mentioned this in my novel, The Transhumanist Wager, the very same thing should be in gender. It amazes me that we have about a 50-50 population in America. And it's still something like, you know, 85% of Congress is men and 15% is women. It should be half and half. And the same thing should happen with age groups. And that way we can have a truly representative society of what really is going on to make some of these decisions. And imagine, for example, if we had a bunch of 25-year-olds in Congress. Well, they would probably be very active with environmental causes. They'd probably be very active with ending the war on drugs. They'd probably be very active with saying, why are we fighting all over the place in the, around the world? Let's stop this. Let's concentrate on things that matter, education and stuff like that. And so, you know, it's important that we actually try to make some of these steps forward. And I have advocated for, you know, changing the laws such that it says, well, we really are a real democracy, as opposed to, you know, something where you have a bunch of mostly old white males who are attorneys leading the country forward. And frankly, they're all religious, and they're not going to stop doing what they've been doing for the last 50 years. And that really just, that doesn't move America forward. That's going to give China and all these other, you know, emerging nations a chance to come up and beat us, both in economics and in cultural ways. And so I really think there needs to be a big change in the way that we choose the people that run our governments. And if we can have a much greater spread of people, youth, of different types of, you know, gender and stuff, and just different political viewpoints, we're going to be a lot better off in the long term and much more representative of what the country might actually want.
What if we have, say, a direct democracy where people can vote in real time on issues like you mentioned before? And in that case, do we even need so many politicians? You know, if people can kind of decide what should happen, then do we need all these guys sitting in an office discussing things all day and making decisions for us?
Yeah, to me, if you're a transhumanist and you believe in the potential of the singularity and all of these things that could happen, artificial intelligence and upgrading our bodies and all of these things that to most people would seem fantastical not in 100 years, that's the thing I hear the most. To me, as someone involved in this kind of thing and seeing the way young people are, the way they're not involved in politics, it seems more impossible to me that we will continue to be running a centralized government than it does that we could be gods in a couple of decades. The idea that all of these technological advances are happening and we're still going to vote every 4 years on a guy to represent us on all these issues, it just seems impossible. Like, we already have the ability to vote decentralized. It's a very simple technology. So for us to still operate on this democratic system that's hundreds of years old and operating on technology that's even older, it just seems so hard to believe. So I'm curious as to why you believe that it will even be an issue with religious people being in politics, you know, decades from now.
Well, you know, so the argument, and I'm not saying it's not going to, it's just, unfortunately, it's going to be a slower transition than I think. And kind of also just going back a little bit to my novel, just so your audience knows, the novel sets up the clash between religious and older people who want to keep the nation the same versus the new technology and the new people who want to change it with some of the ideas you're suggesting. And unfortunately, as I pointed out in a lot of in my recent article on attorneys and vice, where I'd advocated for a law that says it should not be allowed to have 40% attorneys. It should only be allowed to maybe have 10%. The idea is that as long as they're in charge and making the laws, they're going to probably make it impossible for this type of change to occur, unless enough people actually revolt in ways like the Occupy movement and stuff like that, and they just stop working. They literally shut down society. And unfortunately, that's hard because people are so apathetic to some extent. But hopefully, you know, if you get enough journalists and enough people writing about these things and complaining about these things and talking about these things, hopefully there'll be some incremental steps towards a lot of these issues that we want. And I absolutely agree with you. We have the technology right now to do away with the electoral system, period. I mean, we could go right to a straight democracy where everyone votes, and everyone votes within a 24-hour period, and it's on their phone or whatever it is in some booth, and we can actually get to some real where your voice actually is something that is directly tied to the change that's happening. Unfortunately, that really requires a massive shift. And there haven't been that many massive shifts in the country's history, because when you talk about actually messing with the Constitution, it's like, oh, wow, it takes so much to actually do that. You know, America was set up to be a very laborious type of system that could be changed only so slowly. And it was done this way because, they put in these basic tenets of freedom, these basic tenets of liberty, and all these other things. And it was wonderful 200-300 years ago. And for the most part, it's remained wonderful. But the problem is now, as technology, I mean, when the forefathers established the country, they had no idea that there would be internet, that there would be video conferencing, that we would be Skyping, you would be in Vietnam, and I would be here instantaneous. And that's just the beginning of it. I mean, we're at the very tip of the iceberg here. In 15, 20 years, it could just be us communicating via our minds and hundreds of millions of people doing the same thing. So the Constitution itself is absolutely going to need to change as technology becomes quicker. And this is one of the main reasons I actually have formed the Transhumanist Party and, you know, decided to run for the presidency, is to try to tell people, interject my opinion into national politics and say, listen, I don't think people realize how quickly things are changing. For example, artificial intelligence. I wrote an article on this. It's obviously whoever gets artificial intelligence first is going to have such a militaristic advantage over every other nation on the planet that they could literally change the landscape of international politics probably overnight. And therefore, every single country has to work as quickly as possible to be that first person. Whoever has the first artificial intelligence can then stop all the other artificial intelligences sort of from developing. So it makes it this global arms race. And again, nobody's talking about this. Hillary Clinton is certainly not, and nor is Jeb Bush, or nor are some of the other leading candidates, because to talk about it is so thorny, so difficult, that it would literally, you know, wreck their campaigns. What they're still talking about is the same thing we've been hearing for the last 50 years. America needs a new dream. we're going to reduce make Social Security last forever. We're going to lower your taxes or make it so that, you know, the poor people have more to eat and all these other things. You know, it, and a lot of the stuff they're saying is wonderful. And it sounds very noble and very honorable, but they're forgetting a key element, that technology is changing so quickly that in only 5 or 10 or 15 years, so much of the stuff that they want to push forward is not going to make a difference anymore. In a world when we have artificial intelligence, perhaps an intelligence that's much smarter than any president could ever be, why don't we go with that? Why don't we have an artificial intelligence leading us? But that presents so many thorny issues. And the point of the story is that we actually need to start addressing these things. It's not just about Social Security or about taxes or about how to benefit the nation anymore from a kind of economic point of view. It's about how far is technology going to absolutely change the entire landscape of human endeavor? And should we allow these things? Should we not allow these things? How much should we allow? And yeah, I mean, the questions are endless. And I can assure you that no major politician is going to address it right now because they're so thorny. They're going to get everyone in trouble. And only the Transhumanist Party, as far as I know, is the only party that's really out there saying, well, how are we going to deal with designer babies? Designer babies are here. And I think a few days ago, one of the very first designer babies was born and had the ability to already eliminate some hereditary disease. Well, this is very challenging. What if everyone designs to have the same color hair or the same color eyes on their baby or the same sex? You know, I mean, we need to address these questions. I have no idea what Hillary or Jeb Bush thinks on these things.
It just seems more difficult to me to try and make these changes that you're talking about and make people aware and make Congress aware. It seems more difficult to do that than it would be to just wipe the system and replace it with something better. And I know at this point that's what the Occupy movement was about. I feel like Occupy was more of like a attempting to reach a tipping point that it never did. But I still feel like we're very close to that. And in fact, I think that there could be more issues in the way of some of those technologies, or that would make it more dangerous if we still operated under the current political system. Whereas if we were able to replace it, then it seems like we might be on the path a little quicker if we could kind of reduce that transition period. And that's really what I'm wondering, is what is best for us to spend time on, you know, changing the system from within that doesn't want to be changed to begin with, or installing a new system?
Or just creating a system outside of the current system, like all these different decentralized technologies like Bitcoin or different platforms that are emerging all the time, and people just switching over to those systems to the point where the old system just atrophies because of nobody's using it.
Yeah, well, you know, I actually advocate for kind of what you just said, with approaching it from the outside, developing outside systems. I think one of the most important things from a transhumanist point of view to realize is that transhumanists' main goal is to overcome biological death with technology and science. And what often happens from a historical point of view is when you change total systems, you often have a downside or a depression or even a, you know, some type of collapse of society. And I think that's the last thing we want to have. We don't want to have such a dramatic change where all of a sudden the entire, you know, future of the world and all that we had worked for sort of collapses for a couple, you know, decades or 100 years, something like that. So I never have been advocating this overthrowing of what's happening, only because I know that capitalism has been so far promoting the technological advancements that most transhumanists want and that most people want. I mean, the reason we live longer and better, and the reason the United Nations had let out a report last year that poverty is less than it's ever been, more jobs have been there, there's less war going on. So every kind of dynamic or parameter of society has been improving. Now, it's not improving as much as people want, of course, but it is improving. And so I'm definitely for a slow change of the system. And I think maybe, as you had mentioned with Bitcoin and some of these things, there's amazing possibilities to slowly change it so that we can make that evolution to a better system that doesn't necessarily collapse what we have. Because you just have to be careful. Historically speaking, I've covered war zones, so I understand collapses. Collapses are devastating. All businesses stop. All money stops. All food stops. All water stops. All sanitary things like that. War is very dangerous, and you have to make sure that whatever system we take on, the transition itself can be very smooth. And so I certainly want all these changes, and I want a new system, but we must also be careful to some extent that we don't ruin the progress that we've actually achieved. And if that means sometimes, this is why even as an atheist, I've said to many people that I look forward to working with, you know, religious people, or look forward to working with people that might even despise transhumanism, as a means to just say, you know, perhaps it's better that we together try to make these changes rather than have some one, you know, entity or one idea take over the other. And I know that's difficult because, you know, I know a lot of young people are, they feel the revolutionary spirit, but it's very important that we, you know, we don't, I have family, I have a house, you know, I have all these other things that I've worked a long time for. It's important that we don't throw it off to such a degree that the world falls apart, and then we find ourselves in the kind of civil wars and battles that, you know, we read about in the news and in the Middle East and other places. You know, society is delicate. And I know that from some of the war zones I've covered, stuff that can go from being very organized to very disorganized, literally in a matter of days. And so there must be some compromise and some working together. And I think what's really important is that the younger generation keeps telling the older generation, it's time for change. It's time for change. And eventually, hopefully, they'll listen and they'll start making efforts towards that change. And we can meet in the middle, and that change will happen. It'll take longer than we want, but it will happen. And, you know, in 20 years, we'll all be better for it.
Have you read Russell Brand's new book called Revolution?
No, I haven't. I've been meaning to.
It's excellent. I definitely recommend the audiobook version because he actually narrates it himself. But in that book, he talks about how the income gap is widening so much that we're on an inevitable path towards revolution because of that income disparity. And that younger generation, you know, you mentioned you've got a family and a house. Like, people in their 20s and coming up into their 20s, a lot of them don't even have a hope of getting anywhere close to owning property. And this is what Russell Brand talks about, is that the infrastructures are already set up. Like, we've already got plumbing. We've already got roads. We've already got cars. There are certainly some transitions, especially when it comes to food and powering, you know, our civilizations. But the infrastructure is already in place. So my belief is that if we got to a revolution point, it would be messy for maybe a couple of years. But with technology and with the intelligence in America, and with the infrastructure already in place, we could mitigate a lot of that destruction and you know, what you talk about in some of these other countries, the war that happens when things get turned over. I think there's never in the past been anywhere close to a revolution that has started from the state that we're at, where we have such a strong infrastructure to hold it in place. So I'm wondering if you could maybe comment on that.
Well, I just, you know, to be honest with you, it seems almost unimaginable to happen here, mainly because the apathy is so deep. However, despite the apathy, I do think that there is a huge amount of people that would want change, and they're going to make that change happen. It's just going to be probably slower than I think everyone wants. I think what happens is the younger generation has an idea, and it's probably a very good one, and they want it overnight. But there actually, despite that, there was some logic in the way that the American government was set up with checks and balances, where it is difficult to change things. It's smart to some extent. You know, I'm a radical, and I've been a revolutionary, and my novel is absolutely out of the table in terms of how controversial it is. You know, it's very authoritarian. It does all these other things. It's very philosophical. So when most people think of like militant atheism, they think of my novel. That said, I have sort of pulled back and said, you know, to be realistic, how is the best way to get society to progress forward without, you know, hurting the least amount of people? And, you know, I would like to hurt the least amount of people or stop progress the least amount, make the, you know, maximize the amount of health and well-being and resources to the maximum amount of people. You know, how can you do all those things at once? And honestly, I've come to the, you know, perhaps boring point of view that often it's best to work together. It's best to compromise. It's best to take a kind of kumbaya hand in hand and move forward. And I've recently done this with a lot of the religious people that I used to think I would never work with. And all of a sudden I'm, you know, debating with them and talking with them and trying to work out plans with them in order to have a bit more progress, and progress that doesn't kind of change the status quo so that anyone is left at the wayside. I'm hoping that the older generation will accept that type of dance, that type of progress. I know the younger generation wants to move a lot quicker, and I know the older generation doesn't want to move at all. But I think there is a middle ground to us moving all together. And you're right, there's a lot of infrastructure in place, and maybe we could just overnight, you know, turn the tables. In fact, that's one of the reasons why I advocate for certain types of laws being passed. For example, laws where young people must be in government, because that way you actually have a voice that can go against the older generation and say, actually, no, we're standing against you and we have the numbers to vote against you. And so we're going to pass these bills. And these bills say these things must take place. And I'm hoping that through some of these types of ideas that I have presented, we'll have a much better representative kind of government that speaks more of democracy and speaks more of the youthfulness of our nation, as opposed to kind of old, hard ways of the WASP generation and stuff like that. You know, but it's tough because I'm sort of in the middle. I think you guys are probably younger than me. I just turned 42, and I'm sort of in the middle of my age group. And I want to see a lot of peace and a lot of progress. And I used to be quite a bit more radical, but I'm nowhere near as old as some of those old fogies that are running the country right now. So, you know, for me, it's important to try to stay somewhat balanced and to make sure that we can, you know, do this with as little harm to the nation as possible.
We just had a good conversation with the founder of Adbusters magazine. They spearheaded a little bit the Occupy. They at least coined the term the Occupy Wall Street movement. We had a lot of questions for him about, you know, why do you think it failed and how could we improve the next time around? And he says, well, there was never any goal really to begin with it. It was more of an awareness thing. Kali is in his mid 70s, I believe. And he's like, he kind of laughs, you know, we're like, oh, we want revolution now. And he's like, okay, I remember what it's like to be a kid and think the same thing, and it's not really the way these things tend to happen. I think both of you are kind of in the same sort of spot. Like, let's do this a little slower so we don't have so much collateral damage so that we can work within these systems and transition smoothly. The thing that sticks in my head is that I don't feel like if I go to the ballot box, I'm represented very much at all. Because with corporate lobbying, these politicians I'm voting for are bought the second they're in office. There's never in history been a politician who's won that wasn't the most funded. So that's the problem I have, is I think with the corporate involvement in politics and with how deeply involved they are, I don't even believe it's possible, because it's a human system managed by humans, and there are just people so deep into it. I think it's more difficult to change the political system than it is to invent artificial intelligence. It's just because people are involved in it. People are slow. So that's sort of my issue with this, is like, I think in my head I've come to terms with the belief that we absolutely cannot do it from within the political system.
Almost every politician would, well, most politicians would agree to this, that there needs to be reform for how much corporations and lobbyists can actually influence. It's a sham and it's a shame. Because for decades now, it's been very clear that, and I mentioned this earlier in this interview, once you get to a certain level of popularity as a politician, your hands basically get tied if you want to, you know, continue with the status quo. So the way to solve that is just simply to outright pass laws that say, hey, a certain amount of money can be donated, forget these super PACs or whatnot, period. And that's all that can be done. You can't have this extra influence happening, because that extra influence is what changes the entire dynamics of, you know, the political spectrum in America. So unfortunately, that is so difficult to work through. It's amazing. It's very sad that a lot of these changes haven't taken place yet. And I'll also be writing an article on specifically this topic. But if you can be bought, then it's not good for the people. That's just the bottom line, because you're going to be bought by the highest bidder, and the highest bidder just has the biggest pockets, you know, filled with money. So something like that has to change. You need to have people in there that are in there for their own reasons, and those reasons need to be for, you know, representing the will of the people. But, you know, that is so hard to do. I'm not exactly sure why that hasn't. I know they've been talking about reform forever. You know, the last 30 years I've been watching politics, they've been talking about it, but it just hasn't happened.
Obama, a couple of years ago running, it was such a feeling of excitement, you know, and then all of a sudden it's back to the way it was, like just completely the same. So it makes you curious as to how much actual influence
a person can have.
Yeah.
By being in the system.
Yeah, I agree with him. And, you know, I was very excited for Obama, and I feel like Obama is a good human being and wanted to do the right thing. But I believe that his hands have been tied for the majority of the time that he's been in office. And so you kind of come back to this point where you're just like, okay, I'll do my best, But unfortunately, one's best is just not even near what one was hoping for. And even watching, you know, Rand Paul and Ted Cruz and some of these other people launching their campaigns, it's like the American dream. I think they all mean right. But I don't think they really realize once they get into that position, what a giant laborious system it is and how difficult it is. Just because you have your hand on the lever doesn't mean that you can actually move that ship any real direction, except maybe a tiny little bit one direction. And that's what has to change. That bureaucracy has to be cut in half and maybe cut even more. And laws have to be changed so that a person can actually get there and say, well, we're going to do this, and this is the best way to do it. Unfortunately, like you said, I was very excited for Obama, but I don't think it's that he gave up. I think he wanted to do as much as he could, but he found that he was unable to. Literally, his hands were tied.
Yeah, I completely agree with you. I think we're on the same page on so many things here. Mm. It's just how we go about it from the standpoint of what gets us there quickest. This whole idea with Occupy and with liquid democracy and being able to have a direct impact, to me, I think we're asking for the wrong thing with Occupy, especially. You know, everyone's saying demand change and trying to bring awareness to the 99% and the 1%. It was about demanding change, as if demanding anything or asking permission for anything or any kind of dialogue will actually make anything happen. And of course it didn't. In my mind, it's kind of like the biggest difference that would make with the Occupy movements and these movements is what the demand is. And, you know, Kali Lassen from Adbusters is releasing a new sort of a guide to revolution. It's like the Revolution Manifesto. And in it, he asks very front and center, he asks, what do we want? And that's kind of the big question, the big focus for his campaigns. And to me, I think it's obvious what we want. It's how we're demanding for it. And I think demand is the key word here. That's the problem, is that we're asking for permission or we're saying, hey, this needs to change. Like if that movement, if the key word was install it yourself, that we can install this ourselves. You know, look at Bitcoin, how no one asked for permission for that. No one said demand the use of Bitcoin. They just released it. And whether the people use it or not is up to them, but it's actually completely up to them. There's no asking for permission for that. I think the same thing could go with the new political system, with a liquid democracy or democracy OS. Yeah, in my head, that's sort of become the focus recently, is like, how do we install that change ourselves as people rather than asking for that permission?
Or trying to change the existing system by nudging it half a percent of a degree, you know, into one direction or another.
Yeah.
I think the best way to do is sort of with some of the new technologies coming out is that you present them like virtual states and Bitcoin and whatnot, and they catch on because they're useful. And I think that's the main thing, is if you can come up with useful ideas, then you can change the system of things, whether it wants to be changed or not. Because useful stuff is what makes the world go forward. So I'm a big fan of actually the Bitcoin revolution, mainly because I like to see something that is completely a disruptor and disrupting the entire system, and everyone's saying, "Wow, in 5 years could this be our existence?" And you know, I have been working with some of the BitNation people and some of the other stuff like that, and they're presenting brand new ideas. And if it's functional enough, and I think if it makes sense enough, it might catch on. And then you might have this, what we call this perfect revolution, where everybody changes to something better without actually changing their lives, in the sense of nothing has been disrupted, no collateral damage. And that's one of the big things, reasons that I really love technology, is I actually think that we can get to a point when nobody has to endanger themselves, and yet the system itself can change radically just because it was better for us or more useful and more people chose to do it.
So what do you think the biggest thing average people can do to kind of influence the advancement of technology and the advancement of transhumanism and all these things? Because I think, as we've talked about before, a lot of young people just don't really know what to do. I mean, some people are working on advancing these decentralized systems, but what can an average person do?
Well, I think one of the most important things an average person can do is just to use these technologies and to support them. you know, that's really just the key, is everyone all of a sudden started using Bitcoin or whatever, we could change the way the monetary system works very quickly. And that could literally revolutionize the world overnight, because all the banks, everything else would be threatened. And so, you know, there's an underlying grassroots underground kind of message in that, is that you can do that just by enough numbers. And of course, I always advocate for people going into these industries. I mean, that's the most important thing I think people can do, is to say, I'm going to be a developer, or I'm going to go into somehow supporting these industries, rather than supporting advertisement for Walmart, or rather than going into building, you know, more cars or more whatever. I mean, if people really love this stuff, go into the field. And it doesn't mean you have to actually be an engineer, or you have to be a software developer or something like that. You can even just be a promoter. You know, for example, I'm a philosopher and I'm supporting transhumanism. I'm not involved in the science, but I'm still actively there. Everyone can participate in the things they love in. There's so many different angles to it. So that's certainly another thing. And I think the last thing that they can do is really just tell people about it. You know, that's what I try to do on a daily basis with transhumanism, is I just try to tell people about it. Family, friends, people I meet at the supermarket. These are how revolutions start, by just people saying, huh, that makes sense. That's an interesting idea. And the more they talk about it, they go home and talk with their families at dinner, and all of a sudden you wake up one day and wow, that the thing you wanted is sort of here. And so we can make a better world just by talking about it and supporting it. And it sounds very simple. And yet, in many ways, that's all it would take.
Yuvi and I have talked about this before a little bit, about how maybe we're going about this the wrong way in trying to force a change or demand a change or all of these things, whereas the technology can just make it obsolete, make the current systems obsolete. New companies, the new startups that are creating some revolutionary technology, they don't have to fight to replace the existing technologies. That adoption is just fluid. As long as people know about it, they can switch. It's just up to them. There's no barrier. So maybe it's the same thing with politics and world change. I hope so.
Yeah, no, I agree.
I really appreciate you coming on the show and spending the time with us. It was really great to have you.
No, well, hey, thank you. This has been a fascinating conversation. I'm glad we talked about a whole wide range of things, frankly, that I have been wanting to talk about for a long time. So I am actually happy, very happy to have had this talk with you guys.
Cool. Maybe we can have you on the show again in like 6 months or a year to see where things have progressed.
Yeah, it'd be fun. We have a really fun bus tour planned. And so there'll be some, you know, it's an exciting time. And even 1 year and changing in technology, there's so much more to talk about. So I would love that.
Cool. So I hope you guys enjoyed that episode. That was a good one. If you want to check out what Zoltán István is up to, you can go to his website at zoltanistvan.com or thetranshumanistparty.org, which is the website for his political party. If you want to check out the show notes for this episode, they will be at futurethinkers.org/episode15. And if you like our show, please subscribe on iTunes or Stitcher or wherever you want to listen to that. I'm always like trying to stop myself from swearing. Wherever you want to listen to that shit.
You're so gangsta.
Super, super awkward. And we will see you in the next episode. Bye.
Bye.